If you have hyperthyroidism or Hashimoto's and are looking to save your thyroid, then you might want to take the 60-second Save My Thyroid quiz to find out how likely it is that you can save your thyroid. Upon completing the quiz, you will receive your thyroid saving score and a free report explaining your unique results, along with some things you can do to regain your health. To take the quiz, visit savemythyroid.com/quiz. Thank you for joining me on the Save My Thyroid podcast, where I help people save their thyroid and regain their health. My name is Dr. Eric Osansky, and if you have hyperthyroidism, including Graves' disease or toxic multinodular goiter, then you will especially benefit from these episodes. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you also need to save your thyroid, and therefore you will also find many of the episodes to be valuable, including this one where I interview Megan Lyons, who is a nutrition expert, and so it shouldn't be surprising that we did a deep dive into nutrition. It's important to remember that if you were to ask 10 different nutrition experts on what people with thyroid conditions should and shouldn't eat, nobody would agree completely, and the same is true with this interview, as while Megan and I agree on a lot of the things we discussed, we also have some differences in opinions, especially when it comes to soy. As usual, make sure you listen to the post-episode chat after the outro music, as I'll expand on goitrogenic foods, phytoestrogens, stevia and monk fruit, eating 40 bananas in a single day, parsnip fries, continuous cortisol monitors, and Megan's 8-minute morning routine. And you can access the show notes by visiting savemythyroid.com/140. Anyway, here is my interview with Megan.
Welcome to the Save My Thyroid podcast, hosted by Dr. Eric Osansky. To stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics, visit savemythyroid.com. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your doctor. Now let's head to the show.
So I am very excited to chat with today's guest. We have Megan Lyons, and we're going to be doing a deep dive into nutrition, of course, talking a little bit about thyroid health as well. So let me go ahead and dive into Megan's bio. So Megan Lyons is a sought-after health and wellness expert who is deeply passionate about inspiring others to feel their healthiest and happiest. Megan is a Harvard graduate, MBA, and former management consultant who left the business world to follow her passion for wellness by opening the Lion Share Wellness in 2014. Since then, she's earned a master's degree in holistic nutrition, become double board certified in holistic nutrition and clinical nutrition, and she is currently pursuing a doctorate of clinical nutrition and has amassed over 10,000 hours of one-to-one nutrition counseling with clients internationally. Megan runs a top podcast on health and wellness your way with Megan Lyons. Her Revitalized Health Accelerator is a community of health-minded individuals looking to continuously up-level their health and wellness. And thank you so much for joining us, Megan.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, I'm also excited to chat with you. And so let's get started by just giving a little bit of your background. So why did you choose to leave the business world and enter the world of nutrition?
I think like many of our stories, it started with myself. I grew up as a high-achieving kid who didn't really think too much about health. I danced all through my childhood and even through college, but I never really considered exercise or nutrition at all. And in college, I saw a cute guy actually on move-in day, and he was on the track and cross-country team. And so I thought, hey, I should probably start running if I want to get his attention. I did start running. I ended up marrying him several years later, and now it's been 20 years since that. But I, like I said, was a high-achieving kid, so anything that I started doing, I did too much. I did over the top. I started running too much for my body. I started trying to learn about nutrition, but in those days, we didn't have social media or as much internet access as we have now. It was all magazines and some books, but I was reading like fitness magazine, Self magazine, Shape. And what I was reading was eat half a protein bar for lunch and be on the elliptical for 2 hours a day and all this kind of stuff. And so I did it like any good high achieving kid. I kept going and going and eventually just burned myself into the ground. I was 23 when I went into a doctor's office and said, I feel terrible. They thankfully ran my hormones, which actually looking back, I'm somewhat shocked that they did. But I'll never forget the doctor looking at me and she said, you're 23 years old and your hormone, your sex hormones are lower than the postmenopausal women that I work with. I don't know what's going on. You must have to be on medication for the rest of your life. And I just knew that wasn't the answer. I didn't know what the answer was, but I knew that I was doing this to myself, not in a shaming way, but in a way of, if I can take responsibility for this, I know I can figure out how to change it. And so that started me into learning about real nutrition and health. And I always like to say, once you feel it for yourself, you just can't help but share it with the world. So it did take me several years to actually make that decision. I went back to consulting and all of this, but it was burning so much inside of me. I just had to share it with other people. And so I started the Lion's Share Wellness in 2014, and here we are.
All right. That's a pretty cool story. And that's funny you mentioned the, or not funny, but you mentioned the overtraining, because as we were chatting before we went live, I have a history of Graves' disease. And I'm sure that was one of at least the contributing factors. Before I was diagnosed, I was overtraining and dieting, and didn't really at the time, didn't think I was overtraining, just like probably maybe you didn't think when you were running 2 hours on elliptical, you felt great when you were done. And
correct.
You thought, hey, the more the better. So yeah, I didn't think either. At least you had an excuse. You were 23 years old. You said, I was older. I graduated in chiropractic school at the time. I just didn't listen to my body. And yeah, so definitely not only emotional stressors, but those physical stressors could play a role too. So I want to start out by talking about some of the beneficial foods, just because we definitely will talk about gluten and other foods you should avoid. But I want to start out on a positive note. What are some foods that you recommend for people with thyroid conditions to eat, or even just in general, just what are some of the healthier foods? I don't know if there's a difference, like if someone walks into your office or if you're working through Zoom, like virtually with someone, and someone has a thyroid condition, whether it's, let's say, Hashimoto's or a non-autoimmune condition, thyroid condition, or just someone with a different condition, if the foods vary. So you could feel free to go anywhere you'd like to with this.
Great. I think of them two circles, thyroid and general health, but the vast majority of those two circles, maybe 90%, do overlap. There are very few conditions that the nutrition is completely different from the nutrition guidance that I would give to the average person, which is nice. It makes it a little bit easier. And of course, there are various tweaks for every single condition. But when it comes to thyroid health and part of that that overlaps with general health, first, I like to think about really nourishing our body, which we do through all these wonderful antioxidants and polyphenols and all kinds of good chemicals from plants in particular. So berries are some of my favorite foods to recommend. Dark leafy greens are really rich in these polyphenols, all kinds of vibrant colors of vegetables and fruits. And then I also like to think of really good quality healthy fats, which are important for all kinds of hormones, thyroid hormones included. So avocados, olive oil, nuts, seeds to tolerance, depending on the person's gut health, olives, foods like that, and good quality protein as well. So bone broth tends to be one that is generally very well tolerated for people with thyroid conditions and otherwise, but that's a very soothing food. All kinds of good quality proteins, and we can talk about what that means. Then if I'm thinking of some foods that I would particularly recommend to patients with thyroid conditions, I think we often hear about selenium and zinc, which are important. And not knowing, if I didn't know anything else about the person aside from they have a thyroid condition, I probably would recommend some foods rich in selenium, like Brazil nuts, or rich in zinc, like oysters, something like that. Of course, there is a lot more to know in terms of whether or not we need to focus on those nutrients or not. But that's where I would start.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. I want to talk a little bit about bone broth. So I would think you would agree that if someone's willing to make their bone broth their own bone broth, that would be best. But if someone just is like, oh, I don't have the time to do it, I just want to go out and buy bone broth, is it okay for them to get it? Assuming it's like a good quality, like organic, grass-fed, if they're getting like beef bone broth, for example, or...
I say yes. I am very big into let's make this doable for the person. So you're right. I think if we're willing to make it at home, it is the best. And I resisted this for a while because the thought of just putting bones in my Instant Pot was strange. But honestly, it's really not that bad. It's incredibly easy. It takes about 4 minutes of hands-on time. And I find at my local butcher, I can get some extra bones that I know have been well-sourced. But just like you said, if that doesn't feel sustainable, there are several brands out there, Bonafide Provision. I have zero affiliation with these brands, but Bonafide Provisions, Kettle and Fire, there are many others that are making good quality bone broth. And that's a great place to start.
All right. Definitely agree with that. And then with vegetables. So one thing I want to get your opinion on, cruciferous vegetables, because there is a little bit of controversy with cruciferous vegetables and thyroid health, their so-called goitrogenic properties of broccoli and kale and cauliflower. So what's your opinion when it comes to cruciferous vegetables and thyroid health?
So I tend to believe that most foods that nature made can't be that detrimental to us until we overdo it. It is true that cruciferous vegetables have goitrogen, so they are goitrogenic, which can inhibit the thyroid. But actually, it's not just cruciferous vegetables. A lot of vegetables and other foods have goitrogenic properties. It's all about the dosage. So if someone is coming to me with a thyroid condition and saying, oh, I eat 7 cups of raw broccoli per day, absolutely, I'm going to help them change to a different type of vegetable or at least cook their broccoli really well, which can help neutralize some of that. But I don't think that it's necessary for the vast majority of people with thyroid conditions to completely take those foods out. It's all about quantity and moderation. And there are so many great properties of those foods that I would hate for us to completely eliminate it. But I'd also love to hear your thoughts on that.
I agree. I definitely agree that I think in most people, it's not going to be a problem. And I recommend them. Now, again, I do see a lot of people with hyperthyroidism. So if that was the case, I still probably wouldn't say no. Because again, people with hyperthyroidism would probably rather eat broccoli or other cruciferous vegetables than take like anti-thyroid medication. But I actually experimented with that. I tried intentionally using larger amounts of cruciferous vegetables and patients years ago to see if that would work with some of my hyperthyroid patients, specifically pregnant women who didn't want to take medication. And honestly, it didn't work. So it's like you said, maybe if someone's eating a massive amount of raw cruciferous vegetables, and as we both know, usually that's not the case. Most people, we need to encourage to eat more vegetables. They're not eating too many vegetables of even one specific vegetable, but yeah, so I agree with everything you say with regards to cruciferous vegetables. Now, you did mention that cruciferous vegetables aren't the only goitrogens, which is true. So another food, a goitrogenic food that I want to talk about, we don't have to get really into the goitrogenic properties, but it kind of soy. So I want to get your perspective on soy because it's a goitrogen, but there are other reasons. It's not most people or a lot of practitioners, a lot of healthcare practitioners will say to avoid soy. Not necessarily for the goitrogenic properties, but like genetically modified if it's not organic and lectin potentially in soy. So again, I wanted to also have your perspective, and I definitely will give my perspective after you share yours.
Great. I'm interested to hear it because I think this is one of those things that just like eggs, we have flipped so many times on this. And this is in part what is frustrating to people about nutrition science, but also what can be exciting to us as practitioners because we're constantly learning more and figuring out how to actually do nutrition studies. Of course, we can't and don't want to lock humans in a cage for 50 years, but that makes it hard to do appropriate nutrition studies. And now we're just learning how to do it better so we get better information. So that said, my read of the research on soy is that there are actually some beneficial properties to the natural phytoestrogens from soy if it's consumed in whole form. So in edamame, especially organic non-GMO edamame, or in maybe some sprouted organic tofu, something like that. I don't have people shy away from those whole food forms of soy. Now, where I will change my tone is a lot of soybean oil, soybean lecithin in everything, soybean who knows what else, all this kind of processed derivatives of soy. I do think that there is such a thing as too much of that. But whole food soy, especially in organic non-GMO forms, I will support.
Yeah. So my perspective, I agree. I will admit, if I have someone follow an elimination diet, initially I will have them avoid soy almost to play it safe, mainly because it is a common allergen. But with that being said, like organic fermented soy has some great health benefits. I'm not really concerned about the phytoestrogenic properties. I agree with you. I've done research with that and flax seeds, and I think it's beneficial. It's not, it's like estrogen gets a bad rap and people like concern about estrogen dominance, eating soy, eating flax seeds. Those are not going to cause problems. And if anything, might be beneficial.
Exactly. And it's a lot about how we process the soy, that if we have a damaged gut or our detoxification system is not working well, then we're recirculating a lot of those estrogens. That can be negative. But if our body is healthy and operating appropriately, phytoestrogens from soy and flax especially should not cause a problem.
Yeah, I agree. And I also agree with what you said before, drinking soy milk or soybean oil or just the more processed forms, I do recommend for people to avoid that. So we're definitely on the same page with that as well. And gluten. So gluten, is that something that you recommend for, we'll get this out of the way. So most do recommend, at least while healing, to avoid gluten. So let's hear what you have to say with that.
I really pride myself on not being all or nothing, black or white, yes or no on almost everything. But for people with thyroid conditions and honestly a variety of other autoimmune and even non-autoimmune conditions, I do think that a period of 100% gluten-free is important for healing. And I know it breaks people's hearts to hear this. And some people actually in my practice find it easier as opposed to saying, oh, I'm going to have sugar once a week, or I'm going to have an alcoholic drink once a week or whatever, just saying no gluten, that's easier. And that was the case for me. I don't have an autoimmune thyroid condition, but for me, I realized based on my hormonal issues in the past, my gut issues, all kinds of reasons, and just the fact that our gluten today is not that healthy and sprayed with glyphosate and all kinds of other things, it was just easier for me to say 100% no. And I haven't looked back. It's been 11 years or so, maybe a little bit more than that for me. So I can tell you that it's really not that bad, but I understand my client's reaction when at the beginning I say, let's go gluten-free for a few months. And it looks like their brain might explode because it just feels overwhelming. So of course we walk them through it, but I do think that at least in the initial period of healing, we need to eliminate it. I would love to hear your thoughts as well.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And if someone's eating whole healthy foods, then yeah, it's not that difficult. It's making that transition if someone's not eating whole healthy foods. And what some people will do, they'll eat gluten-free cookies and gluten other things that are gluten-free. I can't say that I never eat those foods, or sometimes I joke around and I say, like, it's been years since I've had Graves, so I can't say I never have pizza, like a cauliflower crust pizza, for example. But while healing, I usually would say take a break from even those. Just because it's gluten-free doesn't mean it's healthy. I do agree that some people are like, that's not a big deal. As long as I don't have to give up my coffee, for example, or there's other foods. So you're right. Some people, it is a big deal. Others, there are other foods, or in this case, beverages with coffee, where they really don't want to give up the coffee, but they don't mind giving up the gluten.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, speak of coffee, I don't know. Like, I tell people to take a break from coffee, even though it does have polyphenols and health benefits. So again, it's not a forever thing. But again, I don't know your perspective as far as coffee, if you also like it initially, or again, if it depends on the person's condition that they're presenting.
Yeah, I think the latter. It depends for me on the person And the reason is that many thyroid conditions are related to that HPA, hypothalamic pituitary adrenal, or HPT with the thyroid in their axis, meaning that a lot of it can be stress-based or sympathetic nervous system-based. Even if I change that word based, maybe related. There's something going on with the balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. And coffee and caffeine as stimulants does not allow us to heal that balance. So I do drink coffee personally in moderation. And I think there are many benefits to the polyphenols and even some of the studies to show the actual caffeine in coffee. But during that healing period for a lot of people, I will help them find alternatives. And there are great alternatives out there that maybe are chicory-based coffee, herbal beverages, or other things that can mimic the taste of coffee. And oftentimes, once they get over that initial, oh, that seems scary, then they find the substitutes to be just fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That's good news these days. Like, not only gluten, there's a lot more, even though we said just because something's gluten-free doesn't mean it's healthy. Again, like when someone's on a wellness basis and they want to have gluten-free pizza or gluten-free cookies, there are, in my opinion, delicious options compared to 10, 15 years ago where gluten-free pizza would taste more like cardboard and there weren't as many options. And same thing with the coffee. There are a lot of good coffee substitutes. I'm not a coffee drinker, so I can't say I've tried all of them or most of them, but my wife's a coffee drinker like you. But then also a lot of the patients, they've had experience trying different types of coffee substitutes. So you're right. There are a lot of healthy options out there for those who are coffee drinkers but are taking a break from it.
Yes.
So how about dairy? What are your thoughts on dairy while healing and then as far as eventually reintroducing dairy?
I put dairy in between coffee and gluten, meaning gluten is 100% for almost everyone with a thyroid condition. And coffee, I would say, maybe 50, 60% of my clients who have thyroid conditions end up taking a break from coffee. And dairy is somewhere in the middle. I think that if we had a healthy, robust gut and immune system, a little bit of good quality dairy would not be a problem for most of us. But there are a lot of caveats to that sentence. Most of us don't have healthy guts. Most of us don't have healthy immune systems, especially with autoimmune conditions. And healthy dairy is honestly very hard to find in the United States because we're pumping it with so many hormones, antibiotics, et cetera. So the quality of dairy that we get and the frequency of consumption, which is a lot, many of my clients, without even knowing it, are consuming dairy 7-8 times a day with milk in their coffee and then cheese on their eggs and then cheese on their salad and cheese for a snack and lots of cheese and maybe ice cream for after dinner or whatever. We just know that not only can dairy be mucus forming and make us not feel as great, but it can incite that immune response in our bodies. And we just want to cool all of that stuff off when we're initially healing the thyroid. But I do tend to believe that many people can reintroduce dairy, especially good quality, maybe some real yogurt or some hard Parmesan cheese or something like that after a period of time.
Yeah, I can't say that I never eat dairy. I don't eat it every single day. But I'll have it maybe sometimes a few times a month. Sometimes I might go a few months without it. As far as things like yogurt, I'm perfectly fine with having coconut yogurt. Same thing when it comes to ice cream. I can't say I have two teenage girls. So I can't say I never have any like regular like ice cream, but I'm fine with the alternatives too. And again, you got to be careful. Just because it's alternative doesn't mean that there's other stuff in there. So you want to be careful when reading ingredients, of course. So do you currently have dairy at all?
Dairy's a funny thing for me because I love yogurt. You're right. There are great yogurt options out there, but I just really love yogurt and cottage cheese too. I really enjoy it. Even the ice cream, I'm great with the coconut milk alternatives, coffee creamer, all of that, no problem. But yogurt and cottage cheese, I love. So what happens is I will say, oh, I'm feeling great. I'll bring dairy in for a while and I'll do that. And then I feel great. And then 6 months go by and I realize, oh my gosh, I just consumed dairy twice a day for the past 3 weeks in a row. I'm really pushing my boundaries. So I'll just, we're recording this in early February. In January, I just did a zero dairy for myself just to reset. Just like you, I'm okay with having it 1, 2, 3 times a week. But I know for me, there's a limit and I just need to reset myself every once in a while.
Yeah. Listen to your body. And yeah, everybody's different. So there might be people listening to this, I'm sure there are that are saying, hey, I've been eating dairy daily for years. And that was me years ago. And from what I learned, like you said, the problem is that a lot of people, if not most people, are eating the unhealthier forms of dairy. So it's one thing if they're eating or consuming raw, unpasteurized, not homogenized dairy and the healthier forms, but someone's just drinking regular milk, even if it's organic, it's still processed and at least in my opinion, it's still not ideal to have that every single day. If someone wants it every now and then, again, it really depends on the person.
I agree. And I have, I think, some funny genetics for a lot of reasons, but my mom and my dad, my mom has terrible gut health. My dad has wonderful gut health. He's 75. He's been drinking milk every single day of his life. He eats a lot of cheese and he's honestly fine. Like I've switched him thankfully to organic and better quality and whatever, but he's still drinking organic milk out of a carton and he's fine. And I just know that is not my case. And my mom for sure, not either. So like you said, listening to your body on this one is really important.
Let's talk a little bit about oxalates, because I did hear you I was listening to some of your previous interviews on other podcasts, and just oxalates are a hot topic. And I know your thoughts, because again, I listened to the interview, but I want you to share it with everybody else so they could hear your thoughts.
Yeah, oxalates are a hot topic, just like goitrogens and some other, and soy, because I honestly think, number one, the real foundational principles of nutrition are just not fancy enough to sell very well. If everyone every day says, eat more vegetables, eat more water, eat less sugar, it gets boring and people want something else. And then number two, I think people want something to demonize. So I am not here arguing that oxalates are not a real thing. They are, and they can be a problem. Certainly if someone has existing kidney issues or a variety of other conditions, will I have them be aware of oxalate consumption and reduce it? Yes. But for the average person, I don't put people on a low oxalate diet. Just like the cruciferous vegetables, if I notice that someone is putting spinach in their smoothie and 5 cups, and then they have a spinach salad and they're having kale chips for a snack or whatever, there is a good chance that I will either run an organic acid test or just check in with them to see if they could substitute some of that. But otherwise, I don't think people need to be afraid of spinach or kale or any of the other foods with oxalates unless there's a known issue.
Hey, this is Dr. Eric, and if you're looking to do everything you can to save your thyroid gland, in addition to listening to this podcast, there are a few different ways we can help you. First of all, I've written a book on hyperthyroidism called Natural Treatment Solutions for Hyperthyroidism and Graves' Disease, as well as a book called Hashimoto's Triggers, which of course is on Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and you can find both of these on Amazon as well as other websites where books are sold. Second, you could also join my Graves' Disease and Hashimoto's healing community by visiting autoimmunethyroidgroup.com. And finally, if you want to get personal help from me, you could visit the website workwithdrerick.com. Just to let you know, I only see a limited number of new patients each month, and I do require anyone interested to complete a brief online application before working with me. And now back to the show.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the organic acids test, because I've been having smoothies for years, and in the past, I would stuff it with spinach and didn't really think anything of it. And I did an organic acids test and had high urinary oxalates. And again, it doesn't guarantee that I'd have kidney stones or other issues, but I just, at the time, I figured there were other substitutes. It's not like I can't or shouldn't have any spinach ever again. But maybe I was overdoing it with the spinach and taught me at the very least diversify more. And again, there's other, and I don't recommend like for everyone to follow a low oxalate diet, but there are other substitutes as well. So like for me, it's the same thing. If I see someone overdoing it, I will, you know, say something. I interviewed, I don't know if you're familiar with Sally K. Norden. She has a book, Toxic Superfoods. And she, yes, a very interesting book, which focuses on oxalate. So she was on a podcast and we were talking. And again, it's very interesting. And she's research-based. Like one of the foods that is higher in oxalates is sweet potatoes, which I commonly recommend to people. And since then, I still haven't stopped having, I haven't said, okay, now everybody has to cut out sweet potatoes, but it has made me more aware of, okay, these foods are higher in oxalates and there are some good substitutes, like not to say never eat those other foods, but again, there are other options, but like things like sweet potatoes, I found there's not, unless if I usually have people avoid the white potatoes while healing too. So to me, sweet potatoes, for some people, it's like the savior. I look forward to my sweet potato every day. And again, I've been recommending it for years and can't say that I've seen problems with people eating sweet potatoes and as well as some other foods that are higher in oxalate. So yeah, I admit since the interview, it's been more eye-opening. And like I said, I'm a little bit more cautious, like berries, for example. I can't say I never add blackberries and raspberries to my smoothie, which are high in oxalates, whereas blueberries, according to Sally K. Norden, they're not, and cranberries are not. But again, it did make me aware of it. It's okay. I was rotating anyway. So it's not like I was adding blackberries every day. But like I said, if I was, I probably would start rotating. So I guess for the listeners, I would say, yeah, if you love blackberries or raspberries, I'm not saying to give them up. Sally K. Norden probably would say. But again, there are substitutes if you wanted to. But at the very least, I would say rotate. But I think that's the case with all these foods. Really, you shouldn't be every single day eating spinach. I guess it's okay. But anyway, so I'm of the mindset, it's good to diversify. And yeah.
I agree completely. Diversification is so important with food. And I am one of those people who I could eat the same breakfast every single day for the rest of my life and I would be just fine. I don't crave that much variety, but it really is important to try to break out of our ruts and rotate our food so that we don't develop these intolerances and so that we get an abundance of nutrients. I do encourage people to do that to the extent that it's reasonable. I am not someone who says, oh my gosh, you ate asparagus yesterday. You can't eat asparagus today. Let's not get too dogmatic about it, but get some variety in there. And then just one more thing I wanted to say for the sweet potatoes. Have you ever tried parsnip fries? They're really great. You can make them. A parsnip is like a white looking carrot, and you can just cut them into fry shapes and roast them in the oven. And they have that same mouthfeel as the potatoes and sweet potatoes.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. And getting back to eating something different every day, I guess what I should have said, if I have, like when you go grocery shopping and you get whatever vegetables, you want to use it up before it spoils. So you might use it a few days consecutively. To me, that's normal. But I guess the person who every time they go to, whether it's Whole Foods or a farmer's market or wherever they're buying, if they keep on buying the same exact vegetables every single time, I would say, yeah, if you want to buy whatever batch of vegetables you get, use them up however long it takes. And then next time you go, you know, get some different ones. So I think we agree on that.
Yes, we do.
Can you overdo it with fruit, in your opinion? Can you eat too much fruit?
I think yes is the answer, but most people are not. I will never forget at the beginning of Instagram, whenever that was a while ago, there was a guy who called himself the 40 banana a day guy. I don't remember his real name, but he was literally eating 40 bananas a day. And I just think that's too much. There's no other way to put it. So if you are that guy, then let's make a change. But most people, I don't think that having, let's say, a serving of fruit with breakfast and maybe a serving of fruit as a snack, and then maybe even two, you're sprinkling a couple blueberries on some coconut yogurt after dinner, whatever, that's several servings of fruit. I don't think that's the issue. There are some people with severe dysglycemia who I see who I might work on paring back, especially those tropical fruits like papaya, mango, even banana, pineapple, all of those kinds of things, and trading for lower glycemic fruits. But I just think we're demonizing the wrong thing. If we look at the spectrum of sugar-laden foods, and we're worrying about our blueberries or our apple, and we're still allowing candy and sugary creamers and sugary dressings and sugary yogurts and all of this kind of stuff, we're probably focusing on the wrong part of the spectrum, in my opinion.
I can't imagine anybody eating 40 bananas, let alone 40 of any like food, let alone just fruit, like just
yeah.
You would figure every single, even one day, like 40 bananas in a single day, no. Let alone every single day. That's like just crazy.
It sounds terrible. And I can't imagine he felt good. I mean, he was getting popular, so maybe that felt good, but no, people just take everything to extremes.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, I agree. It's yeah. Let's talk about natural sweeteners. We know that, I'm sure you would agree, try to avoid the artificial sweeteners. And if you don't, definitely let me know like your thoughts on those. But I'm thinking like sucralose. Okay. How about things like stevia, monk fruit? What are your thoughts on those, and as well as other more natural sweeteners?
So I personally consume stevia and monk fruit. I would not say on an excessive basis, but those are not things I shy away from. I will also say, I think the jury's still out on these. I don't think we have enough research to be conclusive on the stevia and monk fruit. I do think we have enough research to be conclusive that sucralose, acesulfame, potassium, all of these disrupt our gut microbiome and can lead to negative outcomes. But stevia and monk fruit, the research is new, in my opinion. I believe that because they are naturally based. And also, I will say we have to be very careful at looking at labels, because some of the packets of stevia is like the last ingredient. It's not actually stevia. It's dextrose or erythritol or whatever else. So really make sure you're getting stevia or monk fruit. But I feel, based on my research, the limited amount of research that exists, that those will be much better alternatives. One more caveat is that they can definitely change our taste buds. So I notice in my clients, people who are having 6 packets of stevia in their coffee and then stevia sweetened, and then they have to put stevia on their strawberries all day, they don't appreciate the natural sweetness of real food anymore. And that leads to increased sugar craving. So I would say have caution, but my current read of the research is a little bit of those is going to be fine. Again, I'd love to hear your thoughts though.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't go out of my way to avoid those. I used to add, again, I'm not a coffee drinker, but I drink green tea, I drink herbal teas, and I used to add stevia. There we go. I used to add stevia to them, and then I just stopped. What happened? First, I added stevia, and then I was also adding honey. So if I had a choice, honestly, I probably would add just like a little bit of honey to it. But just over the last couple of years, I just have had it without having anything. And part of it is also the fasting, which I want to talk to you a little bit about. There's still controversy whether like stevia causes an insulin response and breaks the fast. And I don't think green tea by itself. So I just stopped adding anything to green tea. And herbal teas to me are pleasant even without the sweeteners. So it was the green tea that I can't say I absolutely love green tea. I just drink a cup in the morning for the benefits. And then I just pretty much drink herbal teas after that. I haven't seen anything negative with monk fruit. I know with stevia, potentially, there is some research that it could affect fertility, I believe. Now, again, I forget if that's human studies or rat studies, but just to play it safe, if someone is trying to conceive, they might want to take a break from stevia. Again, maybe it won't prevent them from getting pregnant, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the same study, but it might be. The one that I saw relatively recently, the stevia part was in the headlines, but it was actually lumping stevia, sucralose, other artificial sweeteners together in the study group. So I'm not sure, but I agree. There is zero harm in taking stevia out of your diet, especially if you have concerns like fertility. Why not go to a little bit of honey or train your taste buds to enjoy herbal tea without any sweetener? I think that's not a bad idea in any form.
All right, said. And let's talk about fasting. Let me give my thoughts on fasting. And so, because I mentioned how I do some fasting. Now, when I dealt with Graves' disease, again, this was 2008, 2009, fasting wasn't the hot topic that it is today. And at that time, I was losing a lot of weight. I wasn't in a really good state of health. So I would definitely not have wanted to fast then. And when I work with people today, It really depends on the situation. So I do incorporate intermittent fasting. Typically, I'll go 14 to 16, sometimes a little bit longer. Again, I try not to do extreme fast and I listen to my body. So I do see people doing extreme fast, like 20, like I had a patient who was like doing a 20-hour fast and seemed like she just wasn't getting enough protein just in that 4-hour window because it was every single day and she was doing it to lose weight. But yeah, so I can't say I encourage people necessarily to fast. Like I tell all my patients while healing to fast. Again, it depends on the situation. And many times I will discourage people from fasting if I don't think they're ready for it. So I guess in a nutshell, I do fasting, but I don't think it's a perfect fit for everyone. I think some people could definitely benefit from it. Other people, they might need to heal their adrenals and just overall put on the back burner for until later.
Yes, I completely agree with that sentiment. There is incredible research on the benefits of fasting for autophagy, led by Valter Longo and others, digestion, for healing all kinds of various conditions. And most of that research is either done on mice or on middle-aged non-stressed men. And most of the clients that I see are not mice or middle-aged non-stressed men, because that's really hard to fit all of those categories. Now, do I think the benefits can extend beyond that? Yes, but it becomes more complicated with women. I do think women can fast, and women who have healthy relationships with their body, who are in a stable thyroid and hormone condition, even if that's postmenopausal, I think postmenopausal women are great candidates for fasting. But if you're going through a tumultuous time with your hormones, thyroid, or emotions or stress, I don't think it's the time for fasting for you. Fasting is a stressor. And just like exercise or any other hormetic stressors, which basically means if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger, there's benefit in that. But if our cup is already too high from stress, I'm very emotionally stressed, I'm dealing with whatever kind of social situation, my thyroid is out of balance right now, I'm trying to get pregnant or something like that, like all these stressors, fasting is definitely not the right move for you. So I think, certainly I just said trying to get pregnant, trying to conceive for sure, or pregnant, I would not recommend fasting. Very low body fat or endurance athlete, really training very heavily. Severe dysglycemia, of course, we want to get to the point where we're more metabolically flexible and we can handle fasting, but if you're in the middle of, that's not the time. Eating disorder history, hyperthyroid in almost all cases, and then any kind of like wonky hormonal imbalance. All those categories, I would say no. But if you're not in those categories, then there are great benefits.
Do you incorporate any intermittent fasting personally?
It is listen to your body in practice. What I do for intermittent fasting, which is I actually believe it should be normal. I don't call this intermittent fasting in myself, is just do a 12-hour eating window. That means 12 hours. If I eat dinner finishing at 7:30, I don't eat before 7:30 in the morning. I call it normal because I don't think that should be a stretch for most people. And I do think that's healthy for most people. And then if and when I'm in a low stress state, and that's all relative, right? We don't have continuous cortisol monitors yet, although I hope we do sometime in the near future. But I can tell in my body, if my body can handle it, then I'll push it more. And I won't do it for myself at various times of my cycle. So if you are a cycling female, it's actually better to do it in the first half of your cycle. I won't do it in the latter phases of my cycle. And I just won't do it if I know my body's under too much stress. I think there are so many great things out there and we can't pull all the levers all at once. So I just pick and choose what's right for me at the moment.
All right. Yeah. Continuous cortisol monitors. So yeah, we do have continuous glucose monitors, which I'd love to get your opinion on those. But the continuous cortisol monitors, yeah, that'd be awesome if they do come out with those in the future.
I think it's coming. I really do. I am not ever going to be a person who dives into the technology world or the tech startup world, but I've talked to enough people that are at least thinking about it that I just have everything crossed that's coming.
Very interesting. So yeah, what are your thoughts about CGMs, continuous glucose monitors?
I have worn over 40 CGMs in my life, and each one lasts for 10 or 14 days, depending. So I love them. I also will tell you, being that high achiever person that started my health journey, the very first time I put in a CGM, I thought, oh, this is my job. I eat really healthily. Absolute zero problem. It should be 100% great. And it wasn't. And that stressed me out beyond belief. Like, looking back at some of these graphs, I think, oh, Megan, what were you doing to yourself? But I just got paralyzed by the idea of any kind of glucose bump, to the point where I thought, I can't even eat one blueberry. Oh my gosh, my glucose spikes like crazy. And then I had this day. Dallas doesn't go through freezes very often, but we had very dramatic freeze overnight. All of our pipes froze in my home. I had a humongous presentation that I was really cared a lot about, and I was supposed to drive and I couldn't drive. And I was just stressed beyond belief. I had not eaten anything that day. I had not had coffee, any. I had not exercised, none of that. And my glucose spiked like crazy till I think it was 178. It was very high. And then I realized, okay, look back at your CGM. It wasn't the one blueberry you had. It was the stress about the one blueberry. So I had to get into that mode and realize you don't have to be perfect. It's a learning tool. Ever since that first or second one, I think it's been a fantastic tool. So I would just say, have caution for people. The only last caution I would say is that glucose is not everything, and human bodies are actually designed to have a rise in glucose. So if you eat your salmon and broccoli and rice, and because there's rice and broccoli even in there, you have a little bit of a glucose bump, great. Your body's working exactly as it should. So if you want to consider it as information, I think it's a great learning tool. It's also expensive, so consider that. But it is not the only thing. There are other important things to consider about nutrition.
All right. Thanks for sharing that. And I definitely want you to share your 8-minute morning routine. But before doing that, because of this talk about stress, are there foods that you would recommend to help support the adrenals, since this conversation is focused around food, or any dietary habits? Obviously, we just spoke about not wanting to do extreme fast and, you know, things like that. But are there any specific foods you would actually recommend eating?
Yes. So for our adrenal health, we really want to focus on all three macronutrients: protein, fat, and carbohydrates. I find that most of my adrenally driven clients are eating too low carb, and carbohydrates in a healthy form are essential for adrenal healing. So we don't want, you know, cotton candy and jelly beans, but having some really robust sources of complex carbohydrates is important. And then getting enough protein and healthy fat, all of the macronutrients are important for adrenal health. The one interesting one that I think is in the 10% that doesn't overlap in the Venn diagram is salt. Salt, a good quality salt in moderate doses, is actually very helpful for adrenal healing. So we don't want to go too low sodium with the adrenals, but otherwise it's just really robust sources of all the macronutrients.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the salt, because that's something that I add sea salt to my food regularly and to give it taste, but also knowing that it also helps support adrenals.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that. So let's talk about your 8-minute morning routine, because again, I heard you talk about that on some of the other interviews you did, and would love for you to share that with the audience.
Of course. Back to my 23-year-old hormonal crisis, I realized that I was suffering from something called NTFM syndrome, which is a made-up syndrome by me, but it stands for no time for me syndrome. I just had this mental thing that was like a pity party in my head. I have no time for what I want to do. And then I realized that's actually not true. I have 168 hours in the day, in the week, just like everybody else does. And I can carve out that time for me to create the mental environment that sets me up for how I want to feel during the day. And that's where my morning routine was born. I studied all the famous people's morning routines, and I came up with an acronym, Wake Up and Go. And it's 8 habits, WAKEUPGO, which I'll tell you in a second. There's 1 minute for each habit. I committed myself to doing that for a couple of weeks at a time. And it sounds trite, but I promise you, my life changed. My morning routine is still my most important habit. I just don't feel myself without it. And it makes me so happy and balanced and productive the rest of the day. So the 8 habits, W is for water, big glass of water first thing. A is for affirmations, which for me is just like reading your goals, pumping yourself up for the day. K is for knowledge. There's a lot of great research on learning new things and brain plasticity and all kinds of great stuff. So just reading a page or two of a book. E is for exercise. Even if you're going to exercise later in the day, just do a minute of stretching or jumping jacks or squats or whatever to get your blood flowing. U is for unwind. So we take some deep breaths, meditate, journal, pray, whatever works for you to unwind. P is positivity. Listen to a positive song or read a positive quote. G is for gratitude. We've all heard the benefits of that, just thinking of or writing down a few things you're grateful for. And then finally, O is for one goal, because we all have a million things on our to-do list and we tend to beat ourselves up for the ones we don't do. But just setting that one goal that's going to really make you feel amazing at the end of the day and then focusing on that, I find to be a very uplifting habit.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. Just curious, do you like actually have a timer where it's 8 minutes you have to do these, or do it within 8 minutes, or now is it just like such a routine that, I mean, I'm sure it's not exact. Maybe it is. If you have a timer, then it is exactly 8 minutes. If not, then I'm guessing maybe it's sometimes a minute or two over, a minute or two less. Or
so the real truth is, I did this in 8 minutes a day with a timer, just the way you envision, go all the way neurotic with it. I did that for several years. And I loved that so much that now my morning routine takes a whole lot more than 8 minutes. I wake up early enough and schedule my day so that I can be more relaxed about it. And so now I'm reading for probably 10 minutes in the morning and I'm meditating for 5, and these things just add up. But I have so many clients who literally do it in 8 minutes, and some of them do it with a timer. Some of it just, they do it by feel. So instead of unwind for 1 minute, they just have the goal, I'm going to take 5 deep breaths, which takes about a minute. Just fiddle around with it and you'll get it to work for your schedule. The 8 minutes isn't the magic. That's just the selling point to get people to realize they can do it if they're committed.
Yeah, you might have listened, or I listened, but there's the book Miracle Morning, which I listened to on audiobook, and kind of just, yeah, yes. It's all about waking up early and just getting into a routine and just prioritizing that, because a lot of people, they wake up and they have to check their cell phone, their text messages, yeah, and their emails, and do all these other things that, I'm not saying it's not important, but you definitely want to take care of your health first. I'm glad you shared that and are doing that yourself. So yeah, that is,
yes,
awesome.
Thank you.
You covered so many different things, which I appreciate. Is there anything else that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you, or anything else you'd like to share, or even if you just want to summarize, or just for those who are like, oh, wow, there's so many things that you covered, 2 or 3 things I should focus on?
I think, turn the question back to the audience, because I believe that nutrition and health in general is only successful when it's sustainable. So maybe people heard 8 different things today that sound helpful for them. If you try to go implement all those 8, it will be stressful and you'll likely not end up sticking with it. So I would encourage people to latch on to 1 or 2 things and maybe make some notes about those other ones and you could do them later, but 1 or 2 things to start with. And the corollary factor to that is mindset is so powerful with nutrition, health, autoimmune, healing, everything that we've talked about today. So I encourage people to not think about this as I have to make these changes, or I can't have gluten, or my body hates me because I have this thyroid condition or whatever. But instead, think of it as I now am empowered with knowledge that makes me feel my best. I love my body enough that I'm going to treat it well. I get to make these changes. It feels a little forced and silly to some people, but it truly makes a big difference. So listen to how you're speaking to yourself and try to be kind to your body.
All right. That's some great advice. And Megan, where can people find out more about you?
So I have a website where I've been blogging every week since 2013. So there's a lot of stuff on there. I don't even remember everything that's there. But the website is thelionsshare.org. Lions is L-Y-O-N-S. I'm also at The Lions Share on Instagram. And my podcast is Wellness Your Way.
All right. I will, of course, include all those links in the show notes. And thank you so much, Megan, for sharing everything that you shared. Again, was, I think a real good conversation. And again, you covered a lot of different things, and appreciate you taking the time to do this. And again, thanks also for that 8-minute morning routine, which I know now is maybe not, now you said it's a lot longer, but either way, it's appreciate you sharing that. Hopefully encourage people to wake up. Quick question, what time do you wake up in the morning?
I think this might have room for improvement, but the real answer is between 4:40 and 4:50 every day, just depending on what is going on during the day. And I genuinely love that time. I could obviously sleep longer and not do the morning routine, but it makes a huge difference to me. I also go to bed extremely early, and that feels good to me. I prioritize my sleep. So I'm in bed by 8:30. I would say 95% of the nights, sleep is very important. That's just the schedule that works for me.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thanks again. It was great chatting with you.
You as well.
Thank you for listening to the Save My Thyroid podcast. If you haven't done so already, make sure you hit subscribe to stay up to date on the latest thyroid health related topics. And to get your free thyroid and immune health restoration action points checklist, visit SaveMyThyroidChecklist.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.
That was an awesome interview with Megan. She just shared so much knowledge. A really great conversation. So I definitely put her to the test. I asked her about a lot of different foods. And one of the foods I asked her about was the category of goitrogenic foods, especially cruciferous vegetables. And then we also spoke about soy. And we definitely are in agreement with cruciferous vegetables. So she feels that, I mean, she said this, I think, with most foods, she feels that people, at least healthy foods people could eat. It's when people eat extreme amounts, which usually is not the case with broccoli and cauliflower and other cruciferous vegetables. And as I briefly mentioned during our chat, as well as I think I'm pretty sure I mentioned this in previous episodes too, in the past, I had intentionally given people with hyperthyroidism higher amounts of cruciferous vegetables to see if it could lower thyroid hormones, and didn't have success with that. It would have been great if it did work. I would have just had everybody with Graves and other types of hyperthyroidism just eat a lot of raw broccoli and other raw cruciferous vegetables. But yeah, so we're on the same page with that. Soy, not exactly. I mean, it sounds like she recommends soy as long as it's not processed soy and, of course, GMO soy. But as far as having like fermented soy, it sounds like she doesn't hold back in recommending. And I mean, I'll admit there's definitely health benefits when it comes to fermented soy. And I did mention this during our conversation. I'm cautious though, just because it is a common allergen. It can be harsh on the gut, but the fermentation process will help with that. It's really just because when doing any type of elimination diet, soy is one of the common allergens. And you could say, well, I probably would know if I'm allergic to soy. And I think a true allergy, that probably is the case. But if someone has a sensitivity, they might not know. And again, that's very common to have soy, not only allergies, but sensitivities. I do have people take a break from soy. But once someone has healed, or maybe even before they have healed, if someone absolutely wants to introduce fermented soy, I'm not against it. Obviously, that's ultimately up to the person, even if I don't recommend that. But then we also spoke a little bit about phytoestrogens, and that we both agreed on, because I don't tell people to avoid soy because it's a because of the phytoestrogen properties. Same thing I mentioned, flaxseed. I think those could potentially be beneficial. I really haven't seen evidence that that's harmful. Just people hear about estrogen, and estrogen isn't itself bad. I mean, estrogen is important. It's just that a lot of people have problems with estrogen metabolism. And a big part of that is just the synthetic estrogens, the xenoestrogens out there. It's not our natural estrogens that's the problem. And so phytoestrogens went from soy, from flaxseed, other foods. Again, those are natural as well. So typically that's not going to cause problems. So that's not why it's helped people to avoid soy. And then stevia and monk fruit, she doesn't go out of her way to avoid them. I don't either. I just don't intentionally add stevia like I used to. I used to add stevia to my green tea and herbal teas. And now I just have learned to enjoy them without having that. I mean, the green tea I mentioned, I can't say I love it. If I had a choice, it would be honey, probably not stevia, but just because I'm drinking green tea earlier in the morning. And I do like the fasting. I'm not going to really talk about fasting because I've had some other previous episodes, but sounds like she doesn't do like a 16-8 fast. She definitely does a 12-hour fast overnight. And then when she's hungry, she eats. And there's nothing wrong with that, especially on a wellness basis. I like how I feel when I do a 16-8 fast, but sometimes I'll do only 14 hours. I mean, usually I'm doing a minimum of 14 hours just because I usually don't eat too late. And I just don't eat at like 7 in the morning. If I had to be somewhere, then I would. I mean, I consult with patients, but I don't consult with them like super early in the morning. That's the good thing. I get to create my own schedule. And yeah, anyway, and sometimes I won't, when I have someone early in the morning, I won't. Sometimes I'll eat before, sometimes I won't. But usually I'm not going to eat like that early for me, like 7 in the mornings early. And yeah, I'll leave it at that. So she mentioned the banana eating guy, 40 bananas in a day, who I've never heard of. I still haven't looked him up. I wanted to look up that person on, I guess, on YouTube. But yeah, just crazy. Just some of you might be familiar with the hot dog eating contest on July 4th that they do, like Nathan's hot dog eating contest, which is crazy in itself. But that's just one day. And obviously there's a lot of money involved and it's, yeah, it's different. But this person, it's almost like I think he's doing it just for the attention, I would think, not just, I can't imagine anybody really enjoying eating 40 bananas every single day. And I mean, is he actually doing that every single day? I mean, who knows? So maybe he's just saying that he's eating 40 bananas in a day. I don't know. He probably has multiple YouTube videos where he's documenting it. I'm not sure. But then she mentioned parsnip fries as a substitute for sweet potatoes. I didn't know that, but I will say parsnips, if you're trying to like avoid sweet potatoes and minimize sweet potatoes because of oxalates, parsnips are also high in oxalates. So for that reason, I wouldn't substitute parsnips for sweet potatoes. But if you're just looking for variety, because again, I don't tell people to avoid sweet potatoes because of oxalates. So if you just want some more variety, I think that's a great idea. She mentioned coffee. About 50% of her thyroid patients, she'll have them avoid coffee. Again, for me, it's higher just because, not the polyphenols, obviously, though they're the health benefits, but the caffeine. And a lot of people, if not most people with thyroid and autoimmune thyroid conditions, have adrenal issues. So I usually recommend taking a break from the coffee. That being said, there are worse things people could drink, of course. And especially if it's an organic, a good quality coffee, and they're not adding milk and sugar to it, like a milk-based, dairy-based creamer and sugar. But even if they're just having it black, I usually would recommend to take a break from it, at least initially. It's something, the good news with coffee is that it's not something you have to avoid necessarily for like 6 months. Some people, maybe a month. I mean, if they could do it for 2 or 3 months, that's great. But it also does depend on the state of their adrenals. And then she mentioned continuous cortisol monitors, which was interesting. That was the first time I heard of that. And yeah, that would be pretty cool if they have continuous cortisol monitors in the future. I'm not sure if that would change my approach with testing because I have everybody do either a saliva test looking at a circadian rhythm of cortisol or a dried urine test like the Dutch test, also looking at circadian rhythm of cortisol. But if someone has a continuous cortisol monitor where like a, you know, a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, is monitoring the cortisol all the time, and they probably don't need, assuming it's accurate, which, yeah, so but that's with anything though, including the CGMs. But yeah, if it's accurate, then probably wouldn't need to get the saliva test unless if they don't want to do the continuous cortisol monitor and they just want to do a saliva test. But I know continuous glucose monitors could be pricey, but so could this testing too, at least the adrenal saliva test. Even though it looks, the one I recommend looks at other things, and dried urine testing is also looking at more than just cortisol. But that was interesting. And then I'll just finish up Megan's 8-minute morning routine, which she admitted is really no longer an 8-minute routine, but just reminds me of the book Miracle Morning, which of course I listen to an audiobook just because that's how I maybe read one book a month. Sometimes it takes longer to get through just because I'm doing just so busy doing other things, but I knock out a lot of audiobooks just because I could listen to them while doing certain things. So it's great to have a morning routine. You've already listened, so I won't talk about her specific routine, but yeah, I mean, it's again, great to just first thing in the morning, just do things to take care of your health and not just go on your phone and check your emails and, you know, do other things that are related to work or, I mean, I guess even recreation, but still, yeah, definitely take that time, even if it is 8 minutes or 10 minutes or even 5 minutes, just block out that time. I mean, even if you have a 5 minute morning routine to start out with. So I'm glad she brought that up. And again, really great conversation. I was really impressed with Megan and hope you were impressed with the interview as well. And as usual, I look forward to catching you in the next episode.
I want to let you know about a product called Hepatoimmune Supreme, which is a unique supplement that has a rare combination of N-acetylcysteine, also known as NAC, milk thistle, and schisandra to support the liver. And it also has a few mushrooms that can help support the immune system, including cordyceps, which has both immune modulating and adaptogenic properties and is great for those with Graves' disease and Hashimoto's. To learn more about Hepatoimmune Supreme, visit savemythyroid.com/liver support.